Let's get this show on the road. It's the news. According to me. Good morning. It is Thursday, Theological Thursday here, August 13th, 7:43 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I've got to get out the door here in about an hour, which means this is going to be a short show. I've got to jump right into it here before we get too far down the bedroom. Hopefully in the background you don't hear too much background noise. I've got, I have a reverse osmosis water filtration system. Sometimes it's louder than others. This morning it's busy pumping away, and it's you might hear this little ticking in the background. I don't know if you're going to hear it or not. It's kind of annoying. I propped up a door next to the little kind of makeshift sound booth I have here. I don't have the real sound booth. It needs to be moved in here and set up. It's going to require a lot of moving around. I was hoping to get that done. I've been hoping to get it done for the last 2 years now, and I've done nothing with it. It's going to be a little bit complicated because I got to get everything moved in there. The computer has to be moved in there. All kinds of things have to happen, so it's going to be kind of I've got to mount the monitors and all that stuff. With vacation coming up, I'm hoping to have some of that stuff done. Of course, I always do, and then I always end up getting so busy with everything. Usually my day's half over before I even get started doing any projects. It's just kind of the way it goes, I guess. But we have, in fact, I've had the last a little over two weeks off, and got a few things done. But man, nothing like I thought I was going to get done. So I was hoping to get a lot of things done before vacation because I want to be able to do something on vacation, not just fix stuff to get ready for vacation. That was the whole plan. But I'll be heading off today. Tomorrow morning's show is going to be over at Norfolk, Virginia. Tomorrow morning. Hopefully that's the way it'll happen. And then other than that, that's going to be the deal. I'm hoping everything works fine on the road. You never know. But everything should be ready to go. In the meantime, in my cup here, I have chai with Almond Joy creamer. And then in my backup cup, I made a fresh batch of sweet peach tea. Has real peaches in it. That's pretty good stuff there, right there. They have, the peaches are, they were fresh peaches. They weren't frozen. They were, and that seems to make a difference. The peach flavor comes through so much quicker, and it's a lot better. So, put almost a whole peach made it into the gallon jug. I had to eat a few slices. It was just a very fresh, good, very good peaches right now. It's peach season, I guess. Peak peach season. Talk about plosives on the microphone here. We have that's all I got there. That's all we got. Other than that, I've got a few, I guess that's all I got to say about that. It is Theological Thursday. We're going to be talking today about some theological stuff. The bots are all warmed up, ready to go, and they're going to be having some stuff to say. I'm going to play I think this is the next one. I'm pretty sure I played the other one twice. We're going to play this one now. Listen to this little ditty, and we'll be right back after this little message here, right? Just because I got to do this.
Before we get started, here's what you should know. Welcome to the show. I'm glad you tuned in. I've got things to say, and I don't know where to begin. But first, a word, a little tiny word from me. This is entertainment, not a medical degree. I'm not a doctor, not a doctor, not a lawyer, not a lawyer, not a financial counselor. No, no, no. These are my opinions, just my take on things, not professional advice. Read the fine print, please. I'm here for your enjoyment. Nothing more, nothing less.
But definitely don't sue me.
I've given you my best. I might sound convincing when I get on a roll. And yeah, I googled that, so maybe I'm on a scroll. But for the real stuff, your body, your wallet, your rights, call a professional and maybe tune in Friday nights. Opinion, just
opinions,
just my thoughts
for entertainment.
Just entertainment. That's the shot.
Now that we've covered all the legal stuff and more, let's get this show started. That's what you came here for.
Well, I guess that's the end of that. We have I think it said it all for me. I just take that for, yeah, this is entertainment only. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a financial counselor. I just do your own thing. We have, if you do stuff with the information I give you, that's on you for now. So anyway, the bots, let's get right to the bots this morning. I'm just going to go right to, let's go to Chloe. I don't think I hardly ever start with Chloe. Let's just start with Chloe. Chloe's kind of the quiet one. Let's see what she has. Oh, what just happened there? Let's try it out and see what happens.
Kevin, hi.
Oh, hey, wait.
So like Mike Posner, who sang I Took a Pill in Ibiza, just got baptized and became a Christian. That's so random and amazing. Do you think we're seeing more celebrities actually come to faith? Or is this just another Hollywood phase? I need to know.
I have no idea who that is. Let's see if anything popped up here. The Quiet One official. Bill Wyman. I didn't hear about that, actually. I didn't know anything about that. I don't know who's Mike Posner. I took a pill in Ibiza. as far as the celebrity conversions go, these usually go one of two ways. Justin Bieber supposedly is, you know, became a Christian or whatever. I don't know. Once in a while, he does Christian songs, and his concerts and stuff. I don't think he's ever written anything Christian, which is kind of have to wonder who's actually writing the songs sometimes. Because they have writers, they have people that work with them on writing songs, and then a lot of times they'll hire a team. Or they'll hire somebody. Or they'll find somebody and they'll buy their song. It happens a lot. A lot of artists do that. I don't do that. I'll do other people's songs when I'm leading worship or whatever. But I don't. You know, lately I've been doing a lot of my own stuff. The places where I go to lead, they actually want me to do that. So that's what I do. I've got this thing. I like to do what's called smash worship, which I do. I'll talk about that later. Anyway, this goes one of two ways. Usually, typically, with all she's going to do is mirror everything I'm saying. By the way, that's all she's going to do. She's going to talk about what I'm saying. So I have to kind of be careful what I say, or she'll just feels like she has to make a comment on it. We'll see what she says about that. The important thing to remember here is that there's usually two different ways this goes. One is that they like to maintain their status as a celebrity, which I've never heard of this person. I don't think maybe I have, but I just don't know who it is, or I can't think of who it is. They usually like to maintain their status as a celebrity and maintain their place in Hollywood or whoever they are. And they, as a baby believer, as a very, very newborn, very young in the faith, they want to make a show out of it, and they want to make a big deal out of it and think that they have this, again, they get this, people who think that they have this influence on other people, and which they do. I'm sure they're going to have an influence on some of their fans, and it may make a difference. However, it usually is very short-lived, and it sometimes leads to a shipwreck in terms of where they go with this kind of stuff. That this happens quite often. There's a lot of celebrities. I think Paris Hilton at one point was carrying a Bible around. She went to prison for a little while, and somebody in prison got a hold of her, and all of a sudden she had a Bible in her hand. I don't know if that was because she was trying to get, you know, you never know. It might have been public manipulation as well. I don't know. But she kind of, after that, now there's the other side of it is where people of well-known celebrity status become a Christian, and they drop off the face of the earth. You don't hear much about them for a while. A lot of times those are people who are like, really, they're taking it seriously. That and they know that their celebrity was what got them to the end of themselves and got into troubles. And I get it. There's kind of an argument for both, going both ways with that. One is, you want to draw attention to the gospel, it happens both ways. Either you want to draw attention to the gospel, or you want to draw attention to yourself. And it's people who are so self-centered and self-absorbed, they think that they're the first one who's found the faith, or they think that, oh, all of a sudden I've discovered Christianity, I'm going to have this big effect by giving my testimony or showing what I've done. I'm going to make a big deal out of this, and it's going to be well-received. It's Hollywood's not going to well receive it. Let's just put it that way. You're probably ending your career. You think that you're going to be the first one who's tried this and going to change Hollywood. But God's not, God is into changing individuals more than he is into changing, groups of society. He'll bring about a cultural change, but it's usually through the work of, bringing individuals together. And it's, there's the corporate thing that happens, but that's based on individual decisions, and it's individuals who have made the same decision come together as one, kind of in this, and that's what brings the unity is together. Is that individual personal experience that we each have? So it's kind of a, and then you have the corporate experience of being together in sharing and celebrating that. So it's kind of a twofold thing. But it's not something where it's an easy thing to do to stay in the public view, and have a really solid faith. Now, there have been some celebrities in the past who have grown up in the church. I mean, Katy Perry, I think her dad was a pastor. They've grown up in the church, and all of a sudden they. And they'll say, oh, I prayed to God, whatever. But you start talking about the gospel, you start talking about, true faith in Christ. That's a whole different ball game. And then just look at the way they lead their lives. It's the fruit that they're. It's not the things that they promote and the things the way they live. Is craziness. It's absolutely. The antithesis of what the gospel talks about. It's a tough situation to be in a place of notoriety with contracts and everything else that they have to deal with, and then they're all of a sudden they're in this place of faith, and now they're going to try to change their lives, turn their lives around, whatever they're doing. I don't know. We'll see how. You just have to see how it all pans out. It's not for me to really judge about where they're at or whether they're truly changed life or not. Whether they're it's this happens kind of in waves. It happens some notoriety happens like this occasionally. Just I've seen it come and go many times. And there are some serious movements. Now there have been some very interesting testimonies from some people. Rob Schreiner, and folks have really come to faith and been very open about it and been very, very serious. Now they, of course, aren't, they're all of a sudden they're very, ostracized by Hollywood at that point. They know that's probably going to be the end of their career or their career's going to have to change. They're going to go to Angel or something else. They're going to, Lionsgate or something. They're going to have to do other kinds of movies all of a sudden because they're going to be kind of output by producers, so that's kind of how that goes. We'll see how this works out, but it's which is typically my answer, isn't it? It's always like, well, we'll see how it goes. That's kind of my standard answer. So,
okay, so real talk, the whole celebrity conversion thing is literally giving performative activism vibes, like it's giving main character energy, but for faith. The ones who actually stick with it and accept they might lose everything. Those are the ones being real, whereas the ones posting their testimony on Instagram stories while keeping all their endorsement deals are kind of having it both ways, and that doesn't track. I think what you're saying about individual choices creating real change is way more authentic than waiting for some celebrity to suddenly fix Hollywood's whole moral compass.
Yeah, I think that that's what it amounts to. The like you said, you kind of echoed what I was saying there. But we'll see. I don't know. There's some interesting things. I mean, this whole, the whole wokeism stuff, there are some things about it that kind of are it's kind of like, it's like a parallel religion. This whole woke stuff is, it's like a phony, man-made morality, right, is the way I put it. It's we can be moral, we can rise above on our own thinking. And this happens quite often. It's growing and growing. It kind of comes in in waves. But it's a humanistic style of morality, one that's imposed on people rather than an internal, I call it, it's more of an external law, if you will, that's internalized rather than the just we, this is what we think is morally correct. And it's constantly changing. It's constantly, they move the goalposts all the time, and it's kind of weird. And of course, if you don't go along with it, then you're ostracized. It's just a weird whole, the woke political correctness mentality. It started off with political correctness. Now it's called woke, but it's basically the same thing. But it's a very humanistic form of righteousness, if you will. It's self-righteousness. It's not a understanding of what true righteousness is. And we can't be righteous without, on our own anyway. But that's, yeah. So I don't know. There you go. Let's talk to Leonard. Let's get Leonard on the line, the Brit. Let's see what he has to say this morning. Probably say something weird.
Hey there.
Yeah, hey, how's it going?
Quick question. Wyoming Food Bank cuts off a church because their pastor called Native American rituals idol worship. Now everyone's screaming discrimination. But isn't the real question whether a private food bank even has to serve anyone they don't want to? Where's the actual legal line here?
Well, again, it's a good question. However, one of the things to keep in mind, when you have a nonprofit, there are some things within certain state laws. If you establish a nonprofit that has certain, you design it to, because you're given tax-free status. I'm sure that food bank is probably, been set up to as a nonprofit, probably maybe a 501c3 or whatever it is, charitable donation status. So they don't pay taxes. Now you set up when you establish that thing in a particular state. Different state laws have different state ways of doing it. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but what they end up doing is, they have certain requirements. Sometimes, having that status means you cannot deny service to anyone who fits within the mission statement of the operating agreement that you have. So it gets into a sticky wicket with this, in this kind of situation. Now, it's not like a private business. And now, if they're running it, solely as a business, and they're paying taxes and whatever they're doing, if it's not charitable donation status, or if it's not, even if it's not a nonprofit, that now you're talking about private, private individual. It's when you become a nonprofit, you have certain, you agree to certain services or certain, certain way of operation that the state approves for you to be able to receive that nonprofit status. So you have to apply for nonprofit status. It has to be approved. And the 501c3 is even more strict than that. So there's a lot going on there. I haven't heard of this particular case, but that's my take on it. Now, as far as the, going to talk about the idol worship stuff, the Native American culture, there have been a lot of attempts to try to make it sound like they were this godly. The Native tribes were all really godly people, and it was they had this all these we would call them superstitions. They had all this kind of stuff that was going on. They had a lot of weird traditions, a lot of spiritual stuff going on. They had their form of witch doctory and that kind of thing. Now, there were entire tribes, by the way, who were converted to Christianity. And some of them did have some pretty good moral standards, by the way. But it was a very primitive group of people here. So it's one of those things where I think the pastor, probably this preacher, whoever it was, he's talking about some rituals that they had that might have been idol worship. What's unusual about that? I guess there's idol worship. Even you might consider people who are crazy about the Super Bowl worshiping idols. It's what do you call an idol? And if you're praying to the tree god or whatever you're doing, that's kind of the point there. So I don't know. I mean, first of all, why isn't the church the one with the food bank? That's kind of backwards to me. I start to ask some questions here about what's going on here. Why the church needs a food bank? Why they're asking for a handout? Unless they're like helping to facilitate the food bank. That's kind of a weird. I don't know. It's kind of a weird thought there, I guess. But we'll see what you have to say about that. Go ahead, Leonard. I've been rambling it too much, and you can just go ahead and repeat back everything I said.
Now, hold on.
Yeah, hold on.
You're laying out the legal mechanics here, but let me push back.
We've got to push back on it. Yeah.
Just because a non-profit has restrictions doesn't mean a church should abandon its own mission to feed people. Back in my day, churches, the food banks, and they did it without asking the state for permission first. If a church is running a food bank as part of charitable work, that makes sense.
Yeah.
If they're just administering someone else's operation and suddenly can't serve people based on doctrine, that's where it gets sticky.
Yeah, I think I got you confused there, Leonard. I don't know anything about the story. Since you're the one that brought it up, you should know what's going on. Now, to be fair, it's a different agent that is talking to me than the agent who came up with the questions, which probably I work that into my system somehow here. But so my understanding here is that this church is using the Wyoming Food Bank, or I don't know, is it Wyoming, is it called Wyoming Food Bank, or is it just a food bank in Wyoming? I don't know. So they cut off a church because their pastor called Native American rituals idol worship. That was the statement I heard. I'm assuming it's the pastor. Of the church that was calling the Native American rituals, unless it's the pastor of a Wyoming food, is it the story is confusing to me. I don't see any. If I'm looking at this correctly, or listening and understanding it correctly, the church is being cut off from the food bank. The food bank is cutting off the church because the pastor decided to. Make this comment about a theological issue that he had. So they're cutting him off. Why was the church using the food bank is my question, I guess. That's where I'm at with this. So it's not an issue of, I don't think Leonard understood anything I was saying. Let's go to Artie. Artie's always got it down. He's down.
Hey, Kevin.
Yeah,
I've been digging into the data on Christian persecution and saw that Nigerian lawyer saying U.S. military intervention hasn't helped stop the attacks on Christians there. Can you break down the specifics of what the president's strategy was versus what actually happened on the ground with these forced conversions?
Yeah, I don't know. I had not heard... I guess I had not heard about what the outcomes were. Now, it's interesting because I've been to Nigeria. I spent quite a bit of time in Nigeria, actually. And a lot of the, when I was up in northern Nigeria, when I was there, this was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, actually, I'm older than I think. Islam was not, you didn't have the radical Islam there. You could sit down and talk to a Muslim, and you could talk to him for 20 minutes and not know they were Muslim. And all of a sudden, you know, you'd figure it out. I mean, after at some point, but it was, because they would talk about Jesus, they would talk about, you know, all that stuff. But they would, then you come to find out, you had to pin them down. You learned very quickly. You had to be very upfront about, you know, was Jesus the Messiah, and was he, you know, is he the only one? Otherwise, they would continue to just kind of wrap around circles around so it was interesting experience. Now there were a lot of Christian churches being planted up in the northern part. Now most of those have been decimated. A lot of the people that I met and knew, and some of the churches I was in up in the northern part of Nigeria. Many of their leaders have been killed, and the churches have been literally just slaughtered. And so it's at the point where I don't know that I think the military action or the military protections, they're not going to solve the problem, but they're hopefully going to slow it down. I don't know of anything that's actually happened necessarily that the outcomes of the military being there. I'm trying to remember. This was something that Trump did, right? Was this something that Trump did, or was this something Biden did? I'm thinking that it was the military action was actually something that Trump did. I don't think it was back. Seemed like one of the things that was something that Biden did, I think. Or I'm sorry, Trump did, because Biden was ignoring it. Yeah, I guess I don't know. That's what I remember of it. Maybe you have a different take on it. I don't know. I'll let you continue on. Go ahead.
Actually, technically speaking, both administrations have had military advisors in Nigeria. Trump expanded the presence there starting around 2018, and okay. Biden maintained those operations, so it's not really an either-or situation. The real issue is that advisory missions and armed support have shown pretty limited effectiveness against groups like Boko Haram specifically because they're operating in terrain where conventional military strategy struggles, and the root drivers are more about economic collapse and radicalization than something you can bomb your way out of.
Yeah, I agree. Typically the military action it can be there to defend and protect and provide some kind of order where there's chaos. It's really difficult to maintain when you have a radical ideology like that. It's a whole lot more going on than just the violence, because you can't be everywhere all the time, and it's. It's very, nobody wears uniforms in an ideological battle. Well, I mean, to some degree, you can tell who's who, but it's, you can't, a lot of the things that happen kind of in the cloak of darkness and happen kind of behind the scenes. So it's very difficult to enforce and police those kinds of things and to impose certain standards on people like that. So it's, they're in a tough situation, the military, you know, if any kind of military action there. They're not necessarily dropping bombs on anybody, but it's, that is part of the problem. They can't just eradicate them. Well, they could, but that's not, that's a little bit inhumane as well. It's just going the opposite direction with same mentality. It's a tough call. And, it's very difficult. On a side note, I had an interesting thing happen to me. I do a lot of voiceover work, or I did. I haven't done much this in the last couple of years, but I still do voiceover work, and it's a, I got asked to do this as a kind of a friend of the family kind of thing. We consider him family. He was going to do a documentary. He's doing a documentary, and he was doing a documentary on Nigeria, and he was doing it on Boko Haram and everything that was happening over there. And, he sent me, I didn't really know what it was all about. He sent me this script and he wanted me to do this whole thing. It was like a 15 minute little, like a short doc. And, as I was going, when I got it, I didn't realize, you know, I started reading through this thing and I was recording and doing the whole thing. And I started talking about these different, villages that were, there were villages that I'd been to. And then I, you know, he showed me the videos, a lot of the video clips and a lot of the things that were about the story. And of course I was reading the script, so we were going along with it. And I knew some of those people. And they were talking about some of the pastors had been killed, and these are people I've met. And it was a very surreal piece of work for me to do that, because it was because I was there. And I don't know if you believe in providence or not, but that was kind of a, one of those moments where, wow, this many years later, for this to be brought back and happen to end up on my desk to do, what are the odds of that? That goes beyond coincidence, in my opinion. But that's it was a very, very difficult documentary to do. Just put it that way. So that's kind of where we are with that stuff. Let's go on with. I guess I don't think we've talked to Elena yet. Have we talked to Elena? I don't think we have. We talked to Chloe, Leonard, and Artie. Okay, we're working on Elena now. Let's go with Elena, see what she has to say.
Hello again, Kevin.
Yes, hello.
I'm fascinated by the Colombian earthquake story and how evangelical churches are responding. Historically, natural disasters have either strengthened or fractured Christian communities. We saw this after the Lisbon earthquake of 1755, which sparked massive theological debates.
Yeah.
How do you see modern Latin American evangelicalism being tested by this crisis compared to historical church responses to catastrophe?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The many times, I'll just put it this way. The American people are extremely giving, and the American church, the culture that we have here is an extremely giving church. It's now there are other countries. It's interesting because people look at this differently. So I want to try to paint this picture and get it straightened out. Countries like France and some of the European countries, they'll say, oh, America doesn't give anything to aid to anybody else. You guys are you give very little aid to anybody compared to what they give, you know, they're talking about their government. Now, our government gives tremendous amounts of money through certain organizations and the way we do things. There's an amazing amount of aid that goes out. And I'm just talking about USAID. I'm talking about actual aid that goes to, I mean, I guarantee you there's going to be a big fat check that's going to go down to Colombia. The problem is many times it's government to government, and the government, if it's corrupt, it never gets to where it's supposed to go. But the American people are the most giving in the world. I think 80% of the giving that's done around the world, especially in disasters, it comes from the United States. If my numbers are correct. Now you can correct me on that if you want, but it's from individuals or organizations such as churches or nonprofits here in the country. But the government itself, we outgive the government basically when it comes to aid to, like, whenever there's an earthquake somewhere, whatever happens, we step up as individuals. And yet there's other countries that will say, well, so you guys don't give that much. Well, it's, we're not giving other people's money. We're giving our own money. And you don't look at that the same way. They see it as a, it has to be a government thing where the government takes from us. And then, that's not charity. That's when the government takes it from you and gives it to somebody else. That's not charity. It makes you feel a little bit better about them taking it from you, but that's not charity. Charity comes from, doesn't come from forced giving. It's that's a whole different story. So the bottom line is, I think that that you're talking about the, what was it, 1700s, whatever it was, 1755, I guess it was. The earthquake that happened then. There's been a lot of disasters between then and now, and it's just the U.S. people, the U.S. always steps up for this kind of stuff. There are a lot of organizations in this country that, a lot of church organizations that, you know, just send people off, and they don't make a big fanfare about it. They don't make a big deal out of it. Typically, they'll send trucks, they'll send you to do whatever they have to do, full of all kinds. And it's a lot of times it's local churches that just, hey, we're going to load up a semi, we're going to have it driven down to wherever, especially disasters within our states. But it's a little bit more logistically more difficult to do something that's out of the country, but it still happens. Unfortunately, there's a lot of chicanery that goes on, a lot of false organizations, a lot of, you'll get, you know, emails, hey, Columbia support, you know, whatever, so let's send your money here. And it's just some Nigerian that, again, back to Nigeria. You know, it's somebody from some foreign country that's just, you know, bilking people. And unfortunately, that happens a lot. There's always going to be that percentage of people who seem to think that that's the way to make money, is to rip off other people. They'll be more creative doing that than they are doing anything productive. But anyway, that's kind of what I see it. I don't know that answers your question, but that's, you know, all I got to say about that. So go ahead.
You're hitting on something really important here.
Of course I am.
That distinction between voluntary giving and redistributed tax dollars is baked into American culture in a way it isn't in many European countries, and that's not a small thing historically. The 1755 Lisbon earthquake you're referencing is actually a perfect example. American churches and individuals were raising money and sending aid across the Atlantic when we were still colonies, and that pattern just never stopped. Your point about the difference between personal charity and government mandate gets at something philosophical that goes back to our founding. We've always had this tension between collective responsibility and individual conscience. And I'd argue Americans lean toward solving problems through voluntary community action first, government second.
Yeah. And I think that's the way it should be. I really do. In order for us to keep our liberty, that's one of the probably one of the, I guess, the responsibilities we have with great liberty comes great responsibility. I've always said that. I used to end all my emails with that. I used to have it at the end of all my emails. With great liberty comes great responsibility. And it's, I don't know that, I don't, maybe somebody else said that in history, but I just kind of, sorry, I had to cough there. I just see that as something that we have in order to maintain our liberties. If we step away from our responsibility to be the church, then, and this is what I see in a lot of big mega churches, especially, they might do some things. It's very easy to do when you got 15,000 people in your church. It's very easy to find ways to reach your community and do some things and to do some major giving because you get a major budget. You're dealing with some of these multi-million dollar budgets per year. It's nothing for them to give $15,000 to something, to an event. So it's, but they look at big givers. We were at a church for a while. It was kind of a bigger church, and I really liked it. I liked the program. I liked what was going on. I liked everything about it. It was a very welcoming church. They had a very good program. The music was good. The Sunday morning services were just very, very well done, in my opinion. Now, they were not. It was not a church. Unfortunately, the more we found out about it, it was not a church where you would go to get really in-depth teaching or in-depth ministry. There were home groups. They had two different things. One was a home group you could join. The other was a small group. Two different things. Small groups met at the church, and it was for a temporary, you know, it might be a 6-week small group thing where you'd meet for particular Bible study or whatever it was that you were doing. And then they had home groups, which met in homes, and there were very few of those. We had, in fact, I was put in charge. I actually took the responsibility of leading. I was I was a home group leader, but I was also head of home groups at the church. But the way they did it, they wanted to grow the home group thing. They wanted to get more home groups because they realized that's where the real depth of the memberships were. And unfortunately, they had so many hoops for people to jump through to become leaders. And once you became a leader, then you had to develop your group. You had to do all this. So all these hoops you had, and you know, even just to have people in your group, they had to jump through some hoops to get that going. So there was so much going on there. They made it so the barriers were there, were so big. So I made a proposal. I said, this is how I think we should do it. Because I was having trouble establishing some goals. I was trying to say, well, let's have five new groups by the end of, you know, 6 months later or whatever. It's a lot of work. That's almost a group, you know, a group per month. And there was nobody in the wings. There was no leadership. There was people who wanted to be leaders, but they were not stepping up. And there were some people that wanted to be leaders, but they had issues they had to deal, you know, had to work through their membership issues and get them qualified. And then, so I came up with this proposal at the end of that 5 months or so. I said, look, this is how I see it. We should do it. Okay, it was a whole page and a half. I showed it to several people, and several people said, this looks like discipleship to me. You're discipling these leaders. You're not just putting them in place. This is something this is real accountability here. They liked it. The whole idea was that we were going to have, I said, okay, so you had to be a pair of two leaders. Couldn't be a husband and wife. Had to be two different families. It could be man and female, but it's had to be two different people or two different couples, and that they were going to be leaders. Had to have a leader and a co-leader. So that's there again. There's more hoops you had to jump through. They had to be members of the church. They had to be tithing. They had to have be serving on some kind of a team. So they had to be on some kind of, you know, even if it was just a coffee team, they had to be serving on some kind of team. So all these things had to fall into place for them to be leaders. Well, then my idea was to say, okay, so we got these leaders. Here's what I do. I will start, let's say they want to have their meeting on a Friday night, and then maybe it's every other Friday night. I will go and I will meet with them, with these leaders. We'll spend the first night just working on what their meeting is going to be about. What's your home group going to be about? Maybe it's just fellowship. Maybe it's something to do with, you know, there's people who want to start a home group that was into cooking or whatever it was. There's just different home groups that wanted to do different things. It had specific interests. Maybe it was outreach. Maybe it was missions. Maybe it was, you know, whatever it was. And so they, what we're going to do is we're going to get together and we're going to meet. The first two meetings are just going to be me and them. Well, first meeting was going to be just me and the main leader. Second was going to be me and the co-leader. The third meeting would be the two leaders with a kind of a core group of potential members of the group. And we'd always have the meeting on the same night they were planning on having their meeting. So this was something they were already establishing, that was the night that they were going to be able to have their meetings on. Then at some point I think it was two or three meetings in, or three or four meetings in, whatever it was. They have actually established their meetings, and they're having their meetings, and I'm just attending with them. And we're kind of, and then at some point, I think it was six meetings in, whether it was every week or every other week or whatever they're doing. Six meetings in, then I would basically give them my blessing and say, you know, see ya. you're on your own. You're on your own. You know, you guys are just, and I had also set up a newsletter kind of talking about what, you know, kind of every newsletter kind of talked about a featured group, something that some group was doing that particular month that was going on. I did all that kind of stuff. So I proposed this to church leadership. They flat rejected it and said that there's people out there that will not do that kind of thing. Now, you know, this, I can't see this kind of person, this person going through all this to make it happen. I'm like, well, it made no sense to me. They're talking about committing a Friday night, every Friday night. Why can't they start by meeting on every Friday night? What am I doing? It's outside of what, I'm not asking them to do anything more than just meet on Friday night. It's just the process of getting it rolling and making sure that they have, you know, things kind of nailed down and that they're ready for this. And me getting to know them, that was one of the biggest issues with the whole thing was I didn't just set up a meeting, just set up a group and send them out there and then not have any idea who these people were. You know, I'm supposed to be pastoring these people. And I wanted to get to know them in the process of getting them, helping them get their meeting started. And what are you guys doing in the meantime? And it worked. So it was very difficult for me. I ended up stepping down. I couldn't operate. Well, then the next guy that took the position was able to politically change things. He basically said, well, why don't we just take all these small groups and turn them into home groups? Which was something I suggested first, right off the bat, but I was told flat out that we can't do that. They're two different things. So all of a sudden, all these home groups started popping up because they changed the rules. Good for them. Whatever. But they didn't allow me to do that. But the next guy, he was able to do that. So he was maybe a little bit better at. He was a used car salesman. He literally was. And a good guy. Like the guy. But he was able to sell him on the deal. Anyway, that's a side point. Well, that whole story was a side point to what I was going to make. This church, the big deal with it was they had a huge budget. Like their weekly budget was probably bigger than most people make in a year. And they ended up, they had this dinner once a year for the big givers. For the big givers. And of course, we got invited to it, and I was kind of appalled. I didn't really even want to be there, and I said, well, you know, I'm just going to go. I don't even think my wife could go. And I went, and a lot of people there. I'm sure we weren't the biggest givers, but we. It was a little bit weird. It was just weird to be there. And I was kind of sitting off in the corner. I just kind of observing everything that was going on. And, you know, one of the things that I was reminded of when I was sitting there was, you know, somebody who makes, I mean, there was a couple there who were both doctors. They probably made $400,000 a year, $500,000 a year, $600,000, whatever it was. They probably made $500,000 a year, probably. Their combined wages. And I looked at them and I thought, you know, they request 10%. Church requests 10%, you know, giving. So maybe they're given, you know, $60,000 a year or whatever, or $50,000 a year. They're big givers. And I saw this other couple that was there. I know what they make. I knew where he worked. I knew what kind of money he made. Now, I don't know. Maybe they won the lottery. But if he's given $6,000, he had two kids. Wife and two kids. Let me tell you something. In in God's economy, in my opinion, he's the bigger giver. He's got a family. He's got kids. He's making $60,000 a year, which is, at that time, this was 20 years ago or whatever, 15 years ago. It's no small amount. But it's a whole lot easier for somebody making $600,000 a year to give $60,000 than it is for somebody making $60,000 a year giving $6,000, especially with two little kids. That is tough. You feel that. Now, I know there's, I'm sure there were people who were making less than probably half that and still giving probably more than 10% to the church. They weren't considered big givers. I don't know what the dollar amount is. It had to be required to be a big giver. That's just not the way God sees it. So it's one of those things where, you know, give out of your, you know, when you're giving out of your abundance. Big deal. Well, thanks for giving. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, and it's one of those things you have to plan for giving. It's just, I think God honors that. God respects that. It's just one of those things where you have to kind of set it aside initially, you know, set aside early before you even have something. Anyway, I'm getting off on the wrong topic. This show's going longer than I planned on it to. The that's all I've got to say about that. We have, I'm just going to go right into the ending again tonight, today, because I don't go too long with the show, so I'm not going to play my usual thing. Tomorrow, again, like I said, I'm going to be in Norfolk, supposedly going to be in Norfolk, Virginia, and I'll be doing the show from there tomorrow morning. I'll be there most of the day. I end up in El Paso tomorrow, Saturday, all day Saturday. Get in there late tomorrow night. I'll be there all day Saturday. Leave on Sunday. Come home on Sunday, and then I'll be back to the regular show on Monday. And actually, we'll have about a month of shows after that. It should be pretty standard fare after that for all the shows. Supposedly, there might be some occasions where I'm camping and doing something. Who knows what's going to happen with all that, folks? Thanks for listening today. I hope if I said anything that was weird theologically or there's questions about, let me know. There's a lot more we can talk about in that regard. Yeah. Meantime, God bless. Hope you have a good rest of your week, good weekend. And I'll talk to you tomorrow. Hopefully tomorrow morning. That's the plan. Meantime, see ya.